had a football game yesterday up here in the wilderness, and some of us know a little closer what Job feels like now from all of the agony and the ecstasy of the game. It was good, though. It was good to knock heads. I'd like to begin with a little prayer that expresses something of what my understanding really of, and I think Job is partly the nature of my understanding of how religious experiences and prayer and all that sort of thing happen. You remember the story about Jacob who wrestles with God, or with an angel of God in the night, and at the end of that wrestling, one clearly gets the picture that Jacob, in a sense, wins by virtue of the fact that he refuses to let God go until God somehow or another blesses him. And to some extent, that's really what has to happen in your own religious experience, as I feel it, that you must take on God, wrestle with him to the point where you finally say, God, I won't let you go until you bless me, till you reach me in some way. This kind of struggling is the only kind of religious experience that is ultimately meaningful. There are a lot of superficial kinds of experiences which I will not negate, but I think this dimension is one that is important, is the ultimately important one, and this is what Job is going through to a degree that most of us never ever truly can grasp even. And so the opening prayer is really reflecting that kind of thing. Lord, the edges of my mind and the shape of my world are as fuzzy as the night mist. I am not sure where I am often, where I'm going and why I think the thoughts I do, and whether it's worth searching for something. It's like being in a daze without any sense of direction or a clear road ahead. It's like wrestling with the sand, the endless sand. Is there some old angel in the woods who can grab me by the throat and twist my wandering mind until I feel the real, taste the true, wonder at the world, and get a glimpse of where to go tomorrow? Would you take me on, Lord? Show me the nerves of nature, shock me into my senses until I feel the way? Or will you just shine on the trees and forget about me? Well, I won't let you go until you bless me. Bless me with the instinct of a bird who knows who he is and which way to fly when it's winter. I won't let you go. I won't. Most of you who are here today, I'm sure, have been with us with Job. And I'm not going to bother backtracking very much today. Somehow or another, it's necessary, to come to a conclusion about Job. And in the for those of you who are hanging on for the answer to the riddles of Job, I think I ought to point out in advance, if you want to leave, that you may still be hanging on at the end of this lecture, that I am not going to give you a tabloid form that you can take home and put in your pocket to solve whatever problems you have. All that will happen, hopefully, is that you will feel something of how Job went through the facing of the riddle of his existence, and the riddle of what God it was trying to do in the world, he thought. Now, Job, you recall, wanted an answer. Above all, he demanded that God would show his face and answer him. And if there was to be any kind of meaningful future and direction for his life, God would have to show his face, who he was, and answer the questions that Job was putting. Job wanted to put God on the stand because Job had his case clearly spelled out. Chapter 9, indeed I know for a truth that no man can really argue his case before God. If one tries, God wouldn't even answer one question in 1,000. A little bit later, he says, in that same chapter, verses 16 and following, the translation in some versions is wrong. Let me give you the right one. If I summoned him to court and he responded, I don't really believe that he would listen to me. The problem has become not only that God will not answer, but that if God did appear in court, he really wouldn't hear Job's questions. And in a certain sense, at the end of the book, that's precisely the problem. Does God's answer answer Job's question? He says, if he did appear, he would clobber me with a tempest, with a whirlwind, and rain blows upon me, and I wouldn't be able to get my breath. And in a certain sense, that's exactly what happens. Ironically, what Job expected of God, all of his might, his kind of capricious might, does happen. God does end and answer with a whirlwind and with a tempest. But does he really answer Job's questions? What is it that happens when God confronts this man who's been screaming certain agonizing questions about life and meaning and whatever it's all about, his integrity, his identity, and his whole understanding of what the world is about? How does God answer him? Or is Job right about what God is like? Let me take you another couple of questions from Job's cries still before we look at God's answers. In chapter 13, Job put it this way. I've seen all of this with my own eyes, with my own ears I've heard it. I understand it. But for my part, I would speak with the Almighty. That is, have a court case with him, verse 3. I'm ready to argue with God. Now, we haven't got any of that same old pious resignation that you're not going to answer God back, or that you're not going to get a hold of God by the neck or the arm and force God in some way or another to meet with you. That's one of the things that is part of the dilemma of our worship services, that we somehow or another are so kindly and gentle about it. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, is not the way of Job. Job takes on God. And if there's going to be any ultimate kind of meaningful relationship, you are going to have struggled with who and what God is. And Job does it. I am ready to argue with God while you, like fools, are smearing truth with your falsehoods. I'm ready to take God on. And then he says a little later in that same chapter, verse 13, be silent and let me have my peace of mind. Let what may come upon me. I don't care what happens. At least I'm going to have had the integrity of having fought it out with God. If he slays me, I'm not going to stop. Just if God, to be killed by God is no problem. I'm at least going to go down fighting for an understanding of what it's all about to have a God who touches me in life. I should still argue my cause to his face no matter what happens. Verse 18, be sure of this, once I have stated my case, I really think that I'll be acquitted. I'm the one that's right. God must have done this whole thing for some strange, capricious reason. In a certain sense, Job is right all the way along the line. He doesn't know about, you recall, that deal that God had set up there. That we're going to test Job. He doesn't know about the deal in the sky with Satan, the accuser. So Job keeps demanding that God answer, even though he really is not sure that God will. And that if God did answer, he really wouldn't be honest with Job and answer the questions that Job has been putting to him. And we may ask the question, does Job have a right to pose those kind of questions with that kind of apparent self-righteousness before God? How many of us would pose those questions with the same kind of violence? I think many of us do inside, but feel that we are very guilty if we dare to say cries of agony. We feel we have no right, and we struggle with a new kind of guilty conscience. Because when we do have our doubts, when we do have our agonies, we feel it's wrong. When in reality, they may be the sign of a much deeper a more significant relationship with God. To doubt, to struggle, to challenge is the beginning of a new dying that leads to a new understanding of what God might be doing in your life and your world. Don't knock it. Let all of it be expressed so that you begin to know God anew. Now, how does Job end up all of his cries? Does Job end up by saying, all right, God, now, maybe I've done something wrong? At the end of the whole sequence, in chapters 29 to 31, that's when Job gives his final great summation. It's a very famous section. 29 to 31 is Job's summation of his case. And he summarizes, in a certain sense, his whole life and his whole cause. And that summation of his case is really a kind of public oath of innocence, a public oath of clearance. God, if I've done any of these things, clobber me on the spot. Now let's take a look at that great oath of clearance before we look at God's answer. It's a striking and rather beautiful piece of poetry. Starts off by saying in 29, I got the wrong chapter here, starts off in 29 by saying, if I could only go back to the old days, to the time when God was watching over me nicely, and my lamp shone above my head, and by its light I would walk through the darkness. Everything was lovely. I had everything. Life was comfortable. I had servants. And when I walked in the city streets, all of the elders stood up. When I spoke, everybody listened to me. I was somebody. Somebody in quotes. When I smiled, verse 24, they took heart. When my face lit up, they lost their gloomy looks. I was the most important person in town once. And it would be nice. I saved the poor. He was, in addition, a very righteous man, a man who did all of the right things. I saved the poor when he called for help, verse 12, the orphan who had no protector. I put on righteousness as a garment, verse 14, justice. Verse 16, I was a father to the needy. He did all of those things that a good and righteous leader of society should do. And it's nice to look back to those wonderful days. And in his climactic statement, he remembers all those delightful things. But then he contrasts that with the way things are now. And chapter 30 is the switch to, what's it like now? I used to be the big dog, the top man. Now I am laughed at, verse 1, by men of the younger generation. The boys sneer at me. Men whose fathers I would have disdained, that is the scum of society, to put with the dogs, all of them laugh at me. Verse 9, now I have become the taunts. The target of their taunts. My name is a byword. They loathe me. They shrink from me. They spit on my face. They run wild and savage over me. At the sight of me, they throw off all restraint. And then he closes it all out, that chapter of in verse 19, by saying, and God himself has flung me in the mud. There is no equivocation. Verse 20, I would call for help, but he doesn't answer. There's no answer from God. I would stand up to plead in court, but he sits aloof. God is the one who's the enemy, God the pursuer, and everybody stands there now laughing at him. The last chapter of those three chapters in his great oath of clearance is a statement now, all right, God, I have done none of these things. I am going to swear on a stack of Bibles, if you will, in modern language. Job would just simply write it down on a clay tablet. Look at all the things of which I am innocent. Have I done any of these things? And he lists all of the great things that an ideal righteous man would have done. Just listen to a few of them. I swear that I had no false dealings. Verse 5, I have never been in a course of deceit. Verse 6, let God weigh me in the scales of justice, and he will find that I'm innocent. Verse 7, if my steps have wandered from the way, that is the destined path that's set for it. In my heart, if my heart has followed my eyes, or any dirt has stuck to my hand, may another eat what I sow. And he says, may all these curses come upon me if indeed I am guilty of any of these things. Or another one, verse 13, if I have ever rejected the plea of my slave, or of my slave girl when they brought their complaint to me, what shall I do then if God appears? Why? What shall I answer if he intervenes? Did he not make me and them in the same womb? Did he not create both in the belly? Man and any other man in society is created by the same God, and they're on the same level. And so he goes through a whole list of things, all of which he says are symbols of my innocence. I have done none of these things. And if I have, let the curses fall on me right now. And he climaxes the whole thing with these words. The call for the actual case to come and for God to appear. Let me but call a witness to my defense. Let the Almighty state his case now. I've stated mine. Let God the Almighty state his case. If my accuser has written out his indictment, I would not keep silence and remain indoors. God, in a sense, is the accuser, you see. God is both the judge and the accuser and the one who has to call the court case. And that's his dilemma. No, I would flaunt it on my shoulder if I could. All of the records of my life are right there in public. I do not ever want to hide what I've done. God is the guilty one, he seems to say, and I'm the innocent. Now Job, in all of his super integrity, is willing to call God to account and demanding that God appear. And the question is, why should God bother to answer someone who seems to be so self-righteous? Someone who dares to say what he is and to put it all before God, to challenge God in that way. Let me pause now before we have God appearing. Questions? Comment. And God answers. And there's a speech by another guy here, but I'm not going to bother about that speech. God answers in chapter 38 to the end of the book. Now this is not an easy book to understand, and so I think you have to do a little careful listening when you ask the question, what kind of an answer? Job wanted an answer that had to do with the questions that he asked about suffering, the meaning of existence, why the righteous are the ones who suffer and the wicked prosper, and he goes through a whole spiel about that. The whole question of the meaning of life and of existence in the face of the fact that there seems to be a God of injustice rampant in the world. He admitted that God was a God of might and of wisdom and of power and authority and of all those things. Precious authority, he said. But there it was. All of that. I admit all that. What I want to know is why I am this way in life and why there is no meaning in life when you've done all this to me. Where is the justice of God? Now those questions are the questions of his agony. Does God answer them? When the great answer comes and God storms in from the whirlwind, how does he answer? Listen to his answer. Who is this dumb person with ignorant words, clouding my design in the darkness? Brace yourself and stand up like a man. I will ask some questions now and you answer. But God doesn't answer his question. He says, let me put some questions to you. Let me set before you some of the riddles of existence, the riddles of the Almighty God. And it's like a combat as to whose great experiences and whose questions are the most formidable. And God's questions are of a different kind. Listen to God's questions. Were you there? Were you there when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you know and understand. Who settled its dimensions? Surely you know, verse 5. Who stretched out the measuring line? Who set this earth on its corners? What does God do? He takes Job all the way back to the very beginning of time, to the creation of the world, to the beginning of beginnings, and says, well, do you know anything about that? Now, to go back to the beginning of beginnings is in itself a kind of clue, a kind of an indirect way of saying, that's where you have to go. But it's not a direct answer to the question why the wicked suffer, or why Job has no meaning to his existence at that moment. Go back to the beginning. Were you there? Who was there? Were you there, he says, when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy? At that point, he's referring to the fact that when God made the world, he didn't make it simply as one kind of a series of acts, let there be, let there be. But there are a lot of other traditions about how God made the world in some kind of concord, in some kind of public harmony with all of the heavenly beings. The sons of God mean the heavenly council. And remember, we had those at the beginning of Job. They came to appear before God at the festival time. And the heavenly beings were there. He says, well, were you amongst them? If somebody had been there at the beginning of time, you see, if you go back to the very beginning, you can see how God made the world. You would have watched the process of the creator, the molder, the sculptor of the universe. Job, were you the first man? Now, Eliphaz had said the same thing. Are you the first man that was ever born? Of course, he was saying it very sarcastically. I mean, were you the first person? You must have known all about it. To have all of this kind of wisdom and challenge all the traditions. How come you got this secret information? Were you back there at the beginning when everything was made? Now maybe God is being as sarcastic as Eliphaz was. Does God get sarcastic? Is this almost a kind of retort of God that he answers this way instead of really answering Job's question? Sounds like that in places. A little bit later in verse 19, he says, well, do you know which is the way, the destiny to the home of light, or where darkness dwells? Can you take each of them to its appointed bound and escort it to its homeward path? Come on, Job, surely you know that. Surely you were born then, so long is the span of your life. God argues as if he were a debater. God answers with some of the sarcasm of Job's friends. And he gets to sound very much like Job's friends at some point. The answer of God is a very harsh answer. You are forced to hear this kind of debate. And what God challenges Job to understand is the mystery and the power of God at the beginning of all things. He takes him back to the beginning of time, to when God expressed his power and his fixing of all destiny. Look at a few more of the answers of God. The answers of God are really all questions. In a certain sense, that's the ultimate answer of God that he's going to put to you. It's going to be in a form of a question. If he put an answer to you that was a simple one-word answer, without that word being also a question, that would be the end of the struggle. Every answer of God will also raise another question. And it's an interesting way, in a sense, that that's the way that God does answer Job, is with questions. Listen to some more. Have you ever descended to the springs of the sea, verse 16, or walked in the unfathomable deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the doorkeepers of the place of darkness? Well, maybe, Job, I'll grant you weren't there at the beginning of the world, but have you been able to go to the extremities of the universe? Have you been able to go down to where the death is, where death dwells,
and where it waits for people to come and to receive them to the gates of the underworld? Have you seen that? Maybe you know things by virtue of your experiencing and have traveled the whole universe. I'll grant you some power and some knowledge there. But that wasn't Job's question. Job's question was, why am I in this agony? And God takes him on a tour of the world, on a tour of time. What's God doing? Or have you ever visited the storehouse of the snow? Way up there, verse 24. By what paths does the light spread abroad, or the east wind carry? You know, it goes, now we're into meteorological mysteries. What do they have to do with human agony, these meteorological, magical acts of God? And then he says, well, Job, does the rain have a father? Who sired the drops of dew? He seems to throw back to him some of these old stories about the origin of rain and the myths of the past. He doesn't say whether they're right or wrong. He just simply throws out these old questions that people have been asking. Job didn't want to know whether the rain had a father. He wanted to know whether God was in any sense a father or just. He goes on, or in verse 36, 37, who is wise enough to marshal the clouds? He not only challenged Job's authority and his power, but now he challenges his wisdom. God somehow or other really has to defend his almighty power and his wisdom, and he throws all these things out to show that he is the powerful. And he goes through all of the animals of the wilderness, the mountain goats and the wild asses and the wild oxes and the ostriches and the horses, a panorama of the greatest zoo on earth. Job didn't want to go to the zoo. And yet God takes him. He never says anything about human beings or the everyday things of his life. He takes him to the mysteries of the past, the mysteries of the wilderness, the mysteries of the underworld. And at the end of it, the end of that long tirade and that display of might and power, where he does exactly what Job said he would do, not really answer him, but just frighten him to death. What does God say? This is very interesting. God says in 40 verse 2, which is the end of that first great display of might, God says, well, are you who are disputing the Almighty going to give in so quickly? Come on, should the one who challenges, argues with God, not keep answering back? It's as though Job sort of said, well, I'm not going to argue with that. I said that all along. God said, come on now. God wants a good struggle, apparently. And Job answers in 40 verse 3, verse 4 actually, what reply can I give to that? Really, I'm very small. The word in the Hebrew is, I am very light. I am just a leaf compared with all that might. But really, that's not my problem. I'll put my finger on my, I'll shut up. Keep going, God, I'm waiting. I'll just shut up. Then God, in a certain sense, gets just a little peeved, because Job really did not answer God back this time. He just said, well, I'm nothing compared with that. I understand that. Then God answers Job a second. All right, Job, he says, and this is really what, in a certain sense, honors Job. God now says, let's have it out. Are you a God that is equal to me? Put on all the power that you can and make yourself equal to God. Brace yourself and stand up like a man. The Hebrew word is really a hero. A mighty hero, not just a man. It's a little stronger. And I will ask you and you answer the questions. Dare you deny that I am just and put me in the wrong that you may be right? That's the only reference he has to righteousness. And he quickly passes it by. Have you got an arm like God's? And Job never wanted to have an arm like God's. I don't understand what that arm was doing. Can you thunder with a voice like his? Well, I know you can boom, God. That's not the problem. And then God says, all right, you want, let's have a theophany. You know, be a real big shot, Job. Put on All the prite, pyre, and might, and majesty, and pomp, and splendor, those words are really all the terms that are used of God when he appears in a great cloud of theophany and power and brilliance. Put them all on. Unleash your fury, Job. God wants a real encounter with Job as a rival God, as it were. Extraordinary kind of demand. And when you unleash all your power, you can really whop the wicked across the earth. If you can show that, and if you can destroy all the wicked and show your might and your power with your own big, strong right hand, then I'll acknowledge that your right hand can save you. An ironic kind of response, isn't it? To a suffering man in an ash heap. Ironic indeed. And then God answers with two more displays of power. And it's very difficult to read most of the writers on this because they, I think, in my opinion, partly miss the point of them. There are two figures now that God says, I want you to look at. Two things. After this great challenge, and Job just sort of sits there, what's the answer? What happens? Two things he talks about. One is Behemoth, which is translated in a variety of ways, and I don't know what version you've got and what translation you have. The Hebrew word is Behemoth. Just learn them the Hebrew words because they're really names. Behemoth is the first figure that appears, and the second one is Leviathan. And we're going to sing about Leviathan on Sunday if you're still here. Behemoth and Leviathan. Behemoth is sometimes said to be the hippopotamus. Now, what's the point of talking about a hippopotamus? That's even more ludicrous. And Leviathan is sometimes identified with a whale or with a crocodile. But that too, they may be simply nature expressions of really what he's talking about. When you look at the descriptions of these two animals, these two figures, they are really symbols of the primeval chaos that God had to fight. To understand that in Israel there is a tradition that at the beginning of time, when God made the world, he didn't simply make it with a series of commands the way that you've got it in Genesis 1. That's only one picture. There's another picture that God ordered the world at the beginning by the control of the forces of chaos, the chaos waters, the agonizing waters. And there are a variety of ways of describing those chaos waters. One of them is to portray them in terms of a great sea monster. And in this particular text, it seems to me that he takes two of those old symbols of the great sea monster of the beginning of the world, where the agony and the battle of God takes place. The first of these is Behemoth, and the second one is Leviathan. Look at the first. Behemoth. He devours cattle as if they were grass. Verse 16. Verse 17, his tail is like a cedar. That's no ordinary little hippopotamus got a tail this long. He is, in verse 19, the chief of the works of God, the first great creation of God. Actually, the Hebrew says not chief, but the first of God's great creations. The great chaos monster that God defeated at the beginning. Let's take the next figure, Leviathan. Leviathan is another way, another name that you have in the Old Testament for the great waters of chaos, the great enemy, as it were, of God that God defeats at the beginning of the world when the things are first made. And God plays with him, it says, like a toy in verse 5. But let's look at the description of this figure. This is no ordinary crocodile. Just listen to a few things. Verse 18, 41:18. His sneezing sends out sprays of light, and his eyes gleam like the shimmer of dawn. Firebrands shoot from his mouth, and sparks come streaming out. His nostrils pour out smoke, like a cauldron on a fire blown to full heat. His breath sets blazing coals of fire. That's not an ordinary crocodile. That is the great chaos dragon. That is the figure that God defeated. And the answer of God here is to take Job back and say, consider what I did at the beginning of the world when I defeated all the forces of chaos and made this universe. I made it. What God does is again take Job back to the beginning. He does not answer the question of Job about suffering, but only indirectly says, if you're going to experience meaning, if you're going to experience me, you must experience the beginnings. You must know God in his struggle against the forces of chaos. That's an extraordinary answer. And it's a complex answer. But it's really part of the understanding, the Old Testament understanding of wisdom literature, that you don't experience God by simply accepting a nice tradition. There must be a return to the beginnings, as though you were the first man, as though you were there when God wins the battle over the forces of chaos, as though in a sense he were your enemy and you must struggle with him. Well, Job listens to that great tirade about the zoo and the hippopotamus and the chaos victory and all the rest of it, and what's his answer? Is Job's answer a pious answer, or is Job's answer tongue-in-cheek? Is it ironic? Job has said for chapter after chapter after chapter, I am just and God is the one who has made me look guilty. What's Job's answer? Does Job say, all right, I've sinned, I am guilty, I am wrong? Listen to his answer. Verse 2, I know now you can do all things. Yes, well, he knew that all along. There's nothing new about it. I know you can do all those things. That's fine. There's no purpose beyond you. I know that. And then he says, and I have a strange feeling that this line is close to kind of tongue-in-cheek response. I've spoken of things that I did not understand, too wonderful for me to know. But God did not really reveal anything new that he hadn't said before. Because Job in another text had talked about the great victories of chaos, over chaos. But then comes the real clincher of the last two verses of his response. Very short response to that great display of might. I knew of thee before only of report, but now I see you with my own eyes. That is the first crucial thing. He has now somehow seen God, experienced God, a first-to-first hand encounter with God. And one could just as well almost translate that, I see you, and I see you for what you are. I see what kind of God you are, and I was in a certain sense right. Because what I said was true. God did answer in the way, to some extent, that I had expected. And then the last line, the line that everybody remembers, the line that is very well known. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. The big problem is, how do you translate the word repent? Is Job repenting of a sin? God has not shown him to be wrong. God has not shown him to have done anything wrong. Job has been right, in fact. What is Job saying when he says, I despise myself? And the way I translate the text at that point, and here you'll have to either take it or leave it, the Hebrew is, I will live with my despair, and I will find comfort in being on the ashes. I know that I'm right, that I have known and experienced God, and that there is no simple solution, there is no easy answer, that I will, as it were, be on the ashes of the beginnings, I will be like the first man, and I will have had the assurance, in a sense, that I've experienced God.
But there is no kind of resolution of the problem of why the wicked suffer. That is not answered in the book. Or why it is that Job went through it is not answered to Job. All Job knows is that finally, after the total struggle, he somehow or another knows who he is. That he knows who God is, in the sense what he had experienced in the struggle was the real God of his life. And what's striking is the way that this now ends in the epilogue. Everybody would have thought that Job had somehow or another gone too far. Listen to the verdict of the epilogue. And when the Lord had finished speaking to Job, he said to Eliphaz, "I'm angry with you and your two friends because you did not speak to me as the way you ought to have spoken. You did not speak correct the way that Job has done." In short, all of the traditional answers of the three men are passed off as being not correct. And that Job's way of approaching it was the correct one. Even though in the midst of the dialogue one had the feeling that Job and God were enemies. And indeed they were. That Job had spoken correctly. That his honesty and his integrity and his agonizing battle with God was, quote, correct. And in that verdict, there is the mystery and there is the power. Even though Job ends without having the questions neatly packaged away. For only in recognizing the sense that you must go with God back to the beginning and experience God for yourself anew in all the trauma that the first man does, as though you were the first man, is there a kind of enduring and true understanding of the nature of your God. And in that will be the continuous struggle of life, and in the midst of the struggle somehow comes the meaning. And for those of us who live beyond the New Testament, the ultimate struggle, of course, comes in the man Jesus Christ, who stands before God indicted, stands before God as the one like Job, who is the first man, the man who brings not death like Adam, but life, life in the midst of his struggle. And that God answers not only from the whirlwind, but from the empty tomb.